Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life. Torah isn't education, it's transformation. This is Chai Chinuch with Rabbi G.
101.9 Chai FM, Chai Chinuch, Rabbi G. We are back, as we do every Monday at 11 o'clock, where we discuss different topics, many, many different things that will actually help us improve, learn, grow, anything we want to know so we can be the people we want to be, living in the world we want to live in. What can we learn from our professionals consistently? Tips, ideas, things. And every week we are here with a different topic, as you know, and this week is no different. So the topic this week is we're going to be talking about addiction. You know, we are in holidays. We are at the time of chill. We are at the time that all the risks are out there for starters. And I think we need to address and look at our awareness as a community, as a society. And for that, I have the professionals here in studio with me. I'm going to start and introduce the person that I don't need to introduce because you all know him from his show here already. His name is Nick Ingle. He has a media company, gyms, but really Chai FM presenter. I think that's the best title you can get. And is an addict under control. How do we call it these days?
I'm an alcoholic.
Alcoholic, okay.
I've been sober for 19 years.
Wow. That's
7,158 days.
And hours?
I can check.
Okay.
We have apps, wow. Right?
I'm sure we can. Okay, so let's get... So firstly, good morning. Thank you for being with us today. Just a general word about yourself to introduce yourself to our listeners.
So for myself, really, I started drinking quite early. Pesach, I was 9 years old. And four cups of wine, fell in love. And was already stealing the other kids' wine and hiding it in my pea soup. So I know I'm an alcoholic. Made it very, very simple. I drank up until the age of 36. It nearly cost me my life several times. And I firmly believe that I had 6 months left to go if I didn't stop drinking. And every day since then is extra time. So it's really been wonderful. I have a gym. I do speaking as well at schools, at corporates, at events. I'm a coach, both in terms of executive coaching and strength and conditioning at our gym. And I try and stay connected as much as I can to the recovery community because, they say in Narcotics Anonymous, we keep what we have by giving it away. I've learned we grow what we have by giving
Amazing.
It away.
Amazing. Okay. So we're going to say good morning and thank you to joining us to our other guest here. He's actually one of the leaders in the recovery community. Gareth Lucas, you are the owner of Healing Wings different centers. You quite have a few, actually.
Yes. Yes. Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here. I'm not quite the owner. I'm the executive director. It's an NPO, so Nobody really owns it except... Except
all of us.
The clients, all of us, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. We all own, which is great. So I always have to answer to somebody. We all answer to somebody. Healing Wings, we've got four centers countrywide, two which are in Sedona. And I've traveled a long road with addiction. I've never been addicted. I've never been some might tell you different, but I've never actually been in an addiction center or recovering in the traditional sense. I've had family who have been addicts and who've suffered a lot. And I kind of got into it. I was in the film business. I used to make wildlife documentaries for the international market. And we just kind of fell into it through family and friends. And we supported addiction centers, myself and my wife and my business partner. And since COVID, it's been full time. And in fact, since 2020, it's been full time. But since COVID, right. I've been doing it without the production company. And it's grown, and as has the problem grown.
And so it's very interesting because most leaders I find in this area that have recovery centers and rehabs and halfway houses and groups have been on this journey themselves, have been recovering, are recovering addicts. And it's quite interesting to see someone who is not from that background getting into the field. What was your journey into it?
Well, 100%. 50% of our staff and our counselors are recovering addicts, and they have been through the program, so they understand what they're talking about. I guess I come in from an organizational and a NPO background, fell into it from the business side, not that it's a business. So I come from the organizational and the NPO side. So I'm more, I don't counsel myself. I'm not, you know, I'm not a therapist or a counselor, but I organize it. And as you know, in this business, I suppose everybody's a counselor, whether it's incidental counseling or professional counseling.
Right. Which is, you know, allowing it to happen, but you're still saying that 50% of your counselors are and 50% aren't addicts themselves, which is not generally the standard we see, but I actually think that could give an amazing balance. And I would say, I don't know, Nick, is it because of the 12 steps method of giving back and getting, why is the industry really dominated by people who are addicts themselves?
I think I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for people that got into recovery ahead of me and stayed within the program and stayed connected, kept coming to meetings, kept coming to shares. When I started doing my share, I realized that was the most valuable thing that I could do. So that's on your recovery anniversary, you go to a meeting or to several and you share your life story. And I've always said that as I get wonderful feedback, but I always benefit far more by doing so. And I think it's an incredible thing to be able to walk into a room anywhere in the world, whether you say something or you just sit quietly, and be surrounded by people who understand exactly what you're going through and understand that process. And that's truly the gift. Like, you know, we are the most wonderful society or group to be part of, fellowship, brotherhood, sisterhood, whatever you want to call it, because you are never, ever alone. And in the depths of addiction, in the depths of using, that's when you feel the most alone.
I mean, such a good point. I mean, I walk into a hall of all our residents, our kids, and I start talking to them, and they listen, and then I've seen thousands of addicts come through our centers. But a recovering or an ex-addict or a recovered addict walks into that room, or even a practicing addict walks into that room, and there's an immediate connection, because the addict can spot the BS. He can spot, you know, he knows what
they can feel
about.
Each other, not only understand each other.
He's manipulated himself. And he's the master manipulator. Whereas, you know, I'm still learning. You know, 30 years on in the business, I'm still learning.
Still learning the tricks. It's interesting because we talk a lot about the opposite of sobriety is loneliness, not addiction. And specifically when you talk about such a holding system throughout the world, anywhere you go will be supportive, would make sense why it is actually working.
Absolutely. And I think even more, you mentioned COVID. Since COVID, the online meetings have really grown up and developed. And there's an opportunity wherever you are. I get to travel very fortunately because of what I do. But I know that whatever city I go to, whether it's Hong Kong or somewhere in Tunisia, that there's a meeting around the corner or online, and that brings tremendous peace and a sense of security and belonging.
That's incredible. Now, all the parents listening to us now, or if they're still listening after what you said, they're probably getting very nervous. You mentioned that you got addicted at the age of 9.
Mm-hmm.
That's about 6 years before we would even think about it for our children. Not that we should wait that long to think about it. Is that common? Is that something we need to look out for? Are you unique? Talk to me about that.
I think for myself, I had quite a challenging childhood and background. My late mother was an addict. And unfortunately for her, because she took her own life in 1987, there wasn't the program, there wasn't the support, there wasn't the infrastructure. So she felt tremendously lonely in her addiction. And because of what I had experienced, I found comfort in alcohol. I think also with alcohol, there's a genetic component to it. So if there is alcoholism within the family, something that you need to look out for. And I think it is, you know, if you're going out for dinner and the kid's wanting an alcoholic beverage at whatever age, it's something to look out for. And I think I'm going to perhaps, Rabbi G, be a little bit harsh here. The biggest warning sign, I suspect, for parents, if their child is going to potentially be an addict, is what is their using habit? What are they doing in terms of their alcohol, their vaping, their drug use?
And what they're teaching. And obviously there's the genetic component, which we usually divide into three. And you're the professionals, you two, but we divide between users, addicts, and I think dependents. Mm. And the addicts will have that genetic component, that could be either a addiction in the family or even just a mental disorder that can be that. You know, you speak about that age and that reflection. I know you have quite, Gareth, I'm going to go to you at Healing Wings. I've seen quite young kids at your facilities. I'm sure I haven't seen the youngest, but I've seen as young as 13. What are the youngest clients by you?
Officially or unofficially, because it does make a difference of what we're allowed to take in or what we do take in.
Okay.
But, I mean, first, just an important stat to know is that, SADAC did a stat a number of years ago, and the average age of a drug user in South Africa is 12.
So average. You'll have to repeat that. I'm sorry.
The average age of a drug user, child drug user in South Africa is 12, and this was done years ago. And I've checked these stats, and I've gone back to look at the references, and they're pretty solid. They're out there. And we've seen that in our centers of the parents bringing in their 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds, trying to bring them in. And, you know, we can only accept what we can accept. So while it's a shocking stat and not sure where it comes from, it's come from proper sources, we can see it. We actually see it out there. And we're only seeing the ones that are coming for help.
Mm-hmm.
We're not seeing the ones that haven't actually got to a place where they're asking for help or they've spotted it. Another important thing, sorry, just to continue, but one important thing when you're talking about addiction has got nothing to, or it doesn't have to have anything to do with substance abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Before we go there, mm-hmm. we do need to take a short ad break. Yeah. When we come back, let's explore that even more. And I have also what you said about the age of 12 years old average and 10-year-olds. That's something I'm going to have to react to as well. Stay with us. Stay tuned. Short break, and we will be right back.
Torah isn't education. It's transformation. This is Chai Chinuch with Rabbi G.
101.9 Chai FM, Chai Chinuch, Rabbi G. We are back. And right before the break, we spoke about the fascinating concepts and discussions. I'm here with two professionals in the addiction world, from Nick Engel, that you know him from his show here on Chai FM, or you know him from his media company or from his gym companies or wherever he's done that much, as well as Gareth Lucas, who is the, what would you say the title is? Because is it an MPO?
You can say it's a founder or executive director.
Founder and executive director of Healing Wings. They have four centers. And right before the break, Gareth, you mentioned two things. Number one, that the average age in South Africa of addiction is 12, at least with drugs. And the second thing was, You started to talking about that addiction is not necessarily only on the drugs, or there's certain behaviors, etc. Go ahead with that.
So when we talk about addiction, we immediately think of alcohol, we think of heroin, we think of hardcore drugs. But addiction is a behavior. Mm. Addiction is a way that you behave, a way that you manipulate, a way that you look for attention. So addictive behavior is far different from just smoking weed or having a drink or having too many drinks. You know, it can present itself in self-harming, in cutting, and just behavior traits, in defiance, in certain behavior traits. And becoming an addict, there are certain addict behaviors that especially ex-addicts and ex can actually pick out. But so addiction is a lot more than just substance, and it's a lot more than pornography on computers or any of that sort.
So we can get addicted to tantrums if we are in that space. I could definitely see it happen, by the way. When you actually win a tantrum, it doesn't matter if you're in your 50s with your boss or a toddler or a child, that we do get into that space of repetitive behavior.
I suppose the addiction is not being addicted to tantrums, but it could be, but the addiction is what's causing the tantrums.
Yeah, 100%.
The addictive mindset.
But it does give that
and
great
the
feeling,
the
adrenaline dump. And the okay. So what I'm wondering, and you know, Nick, you speak about speaking in public and speaking in different places and speaking about these things. I think I would consider myself fairly in this space of work, working with kids, with my own center. We have kids. This is news to me that we're talking about a normal reality of 10-year-olds that are addicted. And my question to you is almost, how do we not know about it?
Is this something really that parents or communities would want to share and talk about and put into the spotlight? Or is it something that they feel that they can deal with privately? Go to a bar mitzvah and look at how many kids are drunk at 10 and 11 years old. I remember doing work for and being at a function with a friend of mine, Rob Katz, with his amazing foundation. Right. And the bar, they had an open bar, and one of the elderly ladies who was helping at the
bar. That's called bar mitzvah.
Yeah, there was a bar mitzvah, that's it. Yeah. And they asked me to come over and help keep the kids away from the alcohol because they were stealing alcohol. And I think the kid who collapsed was 13 or 14 years old. They had to call Hatzolah, call an ambulance. So it's very, very prevalent. Perhaps sometimes we don't hear about it because it's also prevalent within the home. You know, if you think about our community and the guy who comes back from work on a Friday, has a whiskey before shul, goes to shul, has a whiskey or two with the boys, comes home, has a couple of whiskeys, couple of glasses of wine, goes to bed early, wakes up in the morning with a bit of a hangover, has a couple of lachaims or the brocha club at shul, goes to lunch, gets shikered, then decides at 2 o'clock he's going upstairs to shlof because it says Shabbos shlof. And that cycle repeats, but really that's someone who's a drunk and is depriving his family of time with him. He's not spending time with his wife on a Friday night after the kids go to bed, or he's not playing soccer in the garden with the kids. So these are the things that are in front of us.
So thank God we don't drive on Shabbos. Mm. But my question to you is, but where are we as people that speak about these topics and leaders? How come it almost sounds like as educators and therapists and professionals, we're not screaming in the streets and in the shuls and in the clubs? Why?
Yeah, great question, because I suppose it maybe comes down to rather ask people than tell them. That might be more effective. I'm sure you get approached all the time. I get approached very often.
You know, it's our campaign that we're running at the moment is you've got to break the silence on addiction. There is a silence. The families, they keep it quiet. They might not think it's a problem. B, they think it's only their problem and no one else knows about it. We get phone calls from distraught mothers who first of all say, I don't think it's a big problem, but my son's doing this, this, and this. Whatever the mother thinks the problem is, it's probably 60-70% worse.
The tip of the iceberg.
It's the tip of the iceberg, because if she's only noticed it now, then there's... The other thing is, when the mother or the parent or the loved one discovers that they're not alone, there are a multitude of people out there having the same questions, the same answers, suddenly they feel relief. They think, wow, you know, it's not just me, and I thought I had to tackle this by myself. They suddenly realize there's a whole industry. There are people like you guys who are talking about it and pick up the phone. And what he's saying is...
Right, which we'll get to the family support system, because I know there's a lot of support beyond the addict. What I want to ask you, Garth, is I'm guessing there are quite a few parents listening to this, and while they're sitting in the car, and when they heard you say, well, parents of 10-year-olds are coming with addiction, they're like, okay, whatever, it's people from certain places, it's not for me, or I think he's exaggerating. Can you share with us real reality of cases, of situations that, yes, 10-year-olds are coming for help, or 9-year-olds?
100%. I mean, we've got a young gentleman, a young boy from a very, very wealthy family, speaks, he's eloquent, he's 11 years old. They've been trying to get him in since he was 9 years old. The addiction is presenting itself as complete defiance. The parents enable all the way. You know, there's a big difference between enabling and support. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
The parents are enabling all the way, and he's become unmanageable. They actually cannot manage him anymore. So he's not addicted to any substance, but he's a case that's waiting to hit the streets. And so I have this 11-year-old boy who's probably 2 years too late, and he is our most difficult case at this stage. He is, you know, we put 3 counselors on him just to manage him and try and work out, you know, do we open a separate kindergarten, you know, and so that that 10, 11, 12, 13-year-olds can have their rehab, and then the rest have their rehab, because this 11-year-old is in big boys jail. You know, he's with the older kids.
So it's almost like a no-brainer that if there are the numbers are that it is a realistic thing. It's not like one child in coming out of nowhere. Then you probably do need to open kindergarten.
Well, this is what we're looking at now. So I'm looking at running a separate program within the youth center that we can take these youngsters, these really youngsters, out away from maybe work allocations, or just to go and climb a tree or look for bugs under the bushes, just to be kids again, because, you know, you have to treat them slightly differently, although they've got the same problem.
Which, because until now, all they were doing was on their phone, which is a whole other topic of the relevance of isolation and lack of movement and exercise, etc., because normal kids in South Africa don't have the opportunity to just climb a tree and run around and ride their bike and go everywhere, which is extremely, depriving, I'd say, from the mental health they need. And I'm one thing that, you know, we've moved on already a few sentences, but a sentence, Nick, you said that is actually really hitting hard. It sounds like as a community, we're literally wasting our Shabbases and in addiction behavior or non-addiction behavior, which, you know, we often refer to ourselves as busy people. At least we want to think that way. And we don't have time to play with our kids necessarily during the week. And we don't have time to, invest that much. But then Shabbos were available and we're just throwing it away. Before you react and we can dive deeper into this, we do need to take a short ad break. And when we come back, we will continue right into this question.
Torah isn't education, it's transformation. This is Chai Chinuch with Rabbi G.
101.9 Chai FM, Chai Chinuch, Rabbi G. We are back and we're right in the middle of a fascinating discussion, at least to me, about addiction and about the reality of our community and challenges of our society. And Nick, before the break, I asked you about addiction behavior that seems like is very common in our community, that Shabbos is a wasted time. Besides for going to shul and davening and a bracha and having a Shabbos meal, great. There's so much time we can spend in connecting to our kids, in investing in them, playing a game, being parents. Is that like not a thing?
So I think it's something we really have to look at, because if 2 units of alcohol is too much for you to drive a motor vehicle, how much is too much to be an effective parent? How much is it to be an effective spouse? So the one thing for me, like why I have so many businesses and do so much and fill so much of my time, is because I need to. I'm an alcoholic. If I don't, quiet time for me is terrible. I'll please God be healthy for a long time and never retire and just stay active. The quiet time is terrible. But having a family around gives us that opportunity to engage and to become the best versions of ourselves. If we're using alcohol to relax, to unwind, to connect, to bond, all of these things. I'm horrified when I go to a synagogue and I visit and the guy say, hey, come, we've got biltong and whiskey, let's go, you know, halfway through davening. It's like, what's the point? There is no value, and I'm going to make a harsh statement here. There is no value in alcohol. In my experience, and I've been fortunate enough to work at several rehab centers training the addicts in recovery, I've never seen value in alcohol in anything, because all that it does is deprive us of the ability to develop the skills that we need. So,
no value at all, or the dangers exceed the value?
So for me, but absolutely, for anyone in recovery, the danger is way beyond. I've been asked many times over the last 19 years, can't I have just one? Can't I have just two? And no. But if you think about it, I had a drink because it helped me relax. What alcohol is doing is depriving you of developing the skills to relax without it. I had a drink because I'm nervous in public and I had to give a speech. It's depriving you of developing those skills. So when we're using the substance for something to change a state or the way that we feel, we're depriving ourselves of developing that skill set. You know, why are you not washing, helping clear and pack the kitchen with your wife after the kids have gone to bed? You know, why are you not up early to study with your son before shul? Why are you not playing in the garden with your
100%.
Kids?
100%. Even playing a game with the kids. We know that for men, oxytocin does come from playing with kids, and you will play with your child and you will get that connecting and bonding feeling. You know, you're talking about that people would come to you and say, why can't you just have one, etc.? And I want to ask you, Garth, you know, people come into Healing Wings and they go through amazing recovery, spend a year with you or less or more, whatever it is, and then they go out into the real world. While sitting here in studio, all of us responded to Nick the same way. When he said he's clean for 19 years, everybody's like, wow, amazing. In the real world, people say to him, okay, you're clean for 19 years. You can't even have one. Come on, it's my bar mitzvah. It's my wedding. It's my simcha. Come on. Do we need to invest more as facilities, as rehabs, into awareness of the public to allow that space of recovery going forward? Or how do we prepare the addicts to the real life when they will be challenged with, come on, just, and specifically if it's someone that has a, okay, I'm going to be careful, it's a morning show, but has an effect on them that they would want to please them, etc. How do we, what are the tools that they need to have?
First of all, I think every recovering addict that's been to any form of rehab knows it's not just one. Everybody, they know that there is, whether they believe it or whether they might say, well, I know I can have one, but in their heads, they've been through the program. They've had to stop for a while. They've recovered. They've gone through detox. They've gone through withdrawals. They know that a little tot or a little this or just a little taste of this or a little spliff on a joint, they know it's over. Once they do that, it's over. They, right. They'll make every excuse in their head. You know, as you say, you know, I've gone through. I've done it 19 years now without touching anything. What's a joint going to do? What's a beer with 2% alcohol going to do? But, you know, it's fine, and that is fine, until it's not. And when it's not, it goes big. I mean, I know a guy who recovered through us for many years. He was staff for many years. He fantastic. He was a chef. He's now got a great job. And I saw him a year ago, and he said, no, I don't know about, you know, all this faith stuff. I smoke a bit of a joint every night to go to sleep.
Yeah.
He's got a family. He's got kids, and I know. And I've told him, say, if he's listening, he would know exactly what I'm talking about. I know that's only a matter of time, because when it's good, it's good.
But I see it all the time when recovering people will tell me, "Now I'm clean for 7 years," and I say, "Clean." And I said, but the drug test didn't come out clean. And I said, no, I just will have weed at before to fall asleep, and occasionally something at a rave, but I'm clean. And we know that's not true, and we know that's a manipulation and everything. So we definitely have that addiction behavior issue. And I'm wondering if we go into more reality that we live in today, would you say, and maybe I'll start with you, Nick, would you say, with all the knowledge you have of addiction, that the average person today or the average teenager today is addicted to their phone?
So I think with one of the consequences of my addiction and life before that is I don't have kids of my own. I was married. I have two wonderful stepkids. And from what I know, whether it's from vaping or from the mobile phone, it's a huge dopamine hit. And very much so. It's very much part of the addiction. And it's anything that we use to change how we feel or remove ourselves from a situation. And more kids, you know, it's the analogy of ending up in your parents' basement and having an online artificial intelligence girlfriend and artificial intelligence social media, social network. We are removing ourselves from pain and challenges and difficulty. And that is a real problem and a real addiction. If I can just go back to the point, I remember being at a friend of mine's son's bris, and a frum guy came up to me, I have a whiskey, I don't drink. Have a whiskey, just one, have a whiskey. And I realized very early on, I was about 6 or 7 months into my sobriety, and I said to him, I'm an alcoholic.
Okay.
Straight in the eyes, I said to him, I'm an alcoholic. And he went white, and that shut him down. And we need in recovery, and it's a huge challenge, and it breaks my heart when addicts in recovery aren't able yet to say in public what they are. And addiction is our superpower, because at the end of the day, the truth is this, that nothing would stop us using. So nothing will stop us getting what we want. So if we want to be sober, nothing will stop us. And that strength that
and
comes
that
from that.
Willpower in a positive way.
So for these kids to give up their phones, and that strength that it takes, they can carry that into any area of their life and build an amazing life. It's not the end of their life. It's the beginning, giving up that phone.
So now I'm going to ask a question that I'm not allowed to ask, but I'm going to ask you, Garth, anyways. 2 weeks ago, it was Youth Day, and had a panel of young, successful youngsters, I'd say, from different communities around South Africa, quite diverse. And one of the big topics of what the youth are challenged with today is employment and work. And we spoke about, you know, their challenges and not enough jobs, etc. And we cover that from different angles. Now that we're talking about that the average person, the average youngster is potentially addicted to their devices, do you think that part of the work crisis and people not having jobs has to do with them being addicts, or that they don't even know that they're addicts, in closet addicts?
Sure, I think it's a very big contributor to it, because I mean, I know from what I know in our centers is that the number one problem we can pinpoint is devices. It's instant gratification of any sort, and what you get on a device is instant gratification. I'm not sure what the alternative is, or I'm not sure what the fix is, because in this society we can't not have our phones or have some sort of device. But I do know that the first thing we do is we take devices away.
So I debate that, by the way, when we say we can't not have the device, because there was a time in history that all the people who bought cars, everybody was just driving, and then the government came and said, sorry, you need a license, and you're not going to drive without a license. And there was a time that everybody who had alcohol, and then the government said, no, you got to be 21 or 18, depends on your country. And there was a time that, you know, we had freedom to sell what we want, and government said, no, we'll intervene. And I think that there can be intervention, and there can be a usage of the, yes, devices are important, but maybe you need to get a license for it, or maybe you need to be at a certain age, at least for some apps. I know that it makes the listeners think that I need to be hospitalized somewhere, or I'm completely cut out of reality. But I do believe that will come a time that there will be more regulation over devices and internet, etc.
I think Australia has brought in a law.
And social media.
Yeah,
right.
16 social correct. Media. What I have to be very careful, because I am an alcoholic, I'm an addict. So I haven't had a television for 17 years. And about 5-6 years into recovery, a friend of mine gave me a TV, and I thought, okay, you know, how bad can it be? I'll try it. Within 2 weeks, I was spending 7 hours a night in front of the television. And that I realized after a week, nope, and I gave it away to a friend of mine. So
It's insane. And do you know what I'll say? I'll actually have self-control, and I'll say it after the ad break. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue with my comment, I guess. Yeah. Short break. We'll be right back.
Torah isn't education, it's transformation. This is Chai Chinuch with Rabbi G.
101.9 Chai FM, Chai Chinuch, Rabbi G. We are back, and we are in a fascinating discussion. And right before the break about addiction and everything, if you're just joining actually now, so I'm here with Nick Ingle, who is a presenter here on Chai FM, but has a media company and gym and very busy, as well as Garth Lucas, who is the founder and... founder and
running,
I guess running. He's the person who makes Healing Wings happen, even though it doesn't belong to him because it's an NPO. Is that a fair statement? Yes. Okay, so you run Healing Wings. And, you know, Nick, before the break, you mentioned the idea of the addiction that can come from TV or device. And I have to say that quite a few years ago, I was interviewing on this show one of the leading professors in brain surgery in Israel. There was a list I saw of the 7 leading doctors of brain in Israel, at least, if not in more than that. And he was on that list. And he said that somebody who plays 2 hours a day on a computer, on a device, gaming, he can see it on an MRI. Mm-hmm. And when I said to him, well, 2 hours is nothing, because everybody does more than 2 hours, he said, so what do you want me to change the MRI? Like, that's the reality. Yeah. So definitely in that addiction space and worry and concern. And, you know, you mentioned that Australia has banned social media. Then why is it so hard? And maybe I'll go to you, Garth, about this. Why is it so hard for parents to actually put in these boundaries for their kids?
Because it's easier not to put in the boundaries. Mm-hmm. You know, give them an
that
iPad.
When
give them an iPad. It's the best babies in the world. It's the most destructive. And that is where we go straight back to enabling, not support.
Mm-hmm.
You hand them a device because, and it, again, the parents in their own addiction are saying, you know, I know it's bad, I know it's frying again, but I'm just going to do it today because I'm feeling really stressed.
I need half an hour.
Yeah, I need half an hour. I need to go and watch my TV show.
Just to detox, right. Yeah. So is there any time that addiction is positive? For example, I've seen addicts, and sorry, Nick, for saying this, I've seen addicts go into bodybuilding and exercising as a replacement for the addiction. Maybe that's a positive. I've seen people go into dancing after they came out of rehab and will dance for 6, 7, 8 hours a day. I've seen people use their powers in addictive ways, but doing healthy things. Is that a problem?
I think there's always a problem if you're over-excessive and you use something as an escape. So if you're using bodybuilding or excessive work or this as an escape to get away from the reality, yes, there's a problem. You know, if you want this to avoid that, then you're avoiding. It's not, you know, you're not recovering. It's avoidance tactics. But as for positivity and addiction, there's so many good stories out there. There's so many great stories. I mean, look at your story. It's a great story. I've been running Healing Wings have been running a school for over 12 years now for addicted kids and substance abusive kids. And, you know, in 12 years, we have not had one matric failure. 100% matric pass rate. And the rest of the grades, 98%, because we had a couple of that. Mm. But in matric, and that these kids, they have been addicted, they've been through, some have come out of Hillbrow, out of, you know, drug holes that have just, and they've come through and they've just persevered and they've got the determination, they've made the choice to give up drugs and to actually go the right way. And they've come through and they've got their matrix.
Well, and that's an outpatient or inpatient?
That's
or
inpatient.
So
we have a youth center, and it's a 9-month minimum course that they can do their schooling, and we have a school.
Well, that's incredible. So one of the things that Healing Wings is known for is being a faith-based program. I will say at that moment, I hope you're okay, that it's been a huge gift from your side and pleasant thing to see that when we connected that you are open to faith as a tool or as a part of life, but you are open to, although it's a Christian-based facility, you were very accommodating for Jewish clients, and we're allowed to do the Jewish faith for them and, you know, let them have that space. Well, I'm wondering, why is faith so important in the recovery process?
I mean, first of all, to clarify, we are faith-based, and we are not a Christian rehab. We are a faith-based rehab that's run by Christians, and that's the way it's evolved through time. And
having
the Jewish influence and having some of your girls come through, and that has been fantastic. It's been, you know, it's taught everybody else about different cultures, and you know, but we accept anybody. You know, you can come and you can believe
whatever you want. Yeah, but I will say that you've been amazingly in accommodating the Jewish needs and prayers and everything. So thank you for that.
You made it easy. Thank you.
Okay.
Your question: why is faith important? Because you need to have a basis of your recovery. You need to believe in something. If you don't believe, you know. The 12 steps teaches us in a higher power. Celebrate recovery teaches us 12 steps to believe in God. You have to have that belief to drive yourself to as a basis for who you are. If you believe in nothing, you come. It's almost standing on an empty on a vacuum.
And how can you believe in yourself?
Exactly. How can you believe if you can't believe in something else?
Go ahead.
So whether you believe in a Christian God or a Jewish God, or you know, you're believing in something that's good, more powerful than yourself and controlling and has the ultimate control, and I think that's important.
So it's interesting. You know, I had a discussion with one of the leading trauma therapists in the world, probably today, who's known very well for going to war zones and conflict areas, and he works in both sides of the conflict. So he works in Russia and Ukraine, and he works in Israel and in Gaza, and he works in I forgot the whole list of that he told me, and he really does amazing work. And he's not a religious guy in any way, yet he was on the show and he told me that with all the methods he wrote and everything that he's done and all the programs, he doesn't know of a way to heal trauma properly when a person doesn't believe in God. Do you also feel that way?
100%. Okay. And I mean, irrespective of my background, where I come from, it's evident in our program, having watched these desperate people come to the program, and as soon as you see that belief, as soon as you see that faith kick in, everything changes because they can make a choice, and then they're not recovered, and it's not the silver bullet, but they've got a direction. Suddenly they've got a base. It's the belief, as you said, they believe in their faith and they believe in themselves, and they move forward. And that's the important
thing. And something happens there. Mm-hmm. Nick, do you see it the same way?
Absolutely. If you don't believe in Hashem and God, you don't have that opportunity to see your own real value, how special you were, that you were created. And that belief of I am a cog, however small, in a machine, but I'm essential. And once you start to have that, you can start to say, hang on, I'm going through this for a reason. I don't know what that reason is, but if I know if I take advantage of my gifts, then I can contribute. And that comes back to getting involved in the program, being part of the community, and adding value. To go from a place of arrogance and self-loathing into a place of, please God, humility and service is the most wonderful transition that we can do, and the most wonderful gift that we can give ourselves.
Amazing. So yeah, definitely that way. We do need to take our last ad break for today's show, and then we will come back and start heading towards the end of the hour. Really fascinating, but a short break, and we have a bit more left, so just stay with us and we will be right back.
Torah isn't education, it's transformation. This is Chai Chinuch with Rabbi G.
101.9 Chai FM, Chai Chinuch, Rabbi G. We are back, and we're really towards the end of the hour. Wish we had more time. And by the way, if you're joining now, I'm here with Nick Ingle, and we have Gareth Lucas, who is the leader, let me call you leader, of Healing Wings. And by the way, this is so important for every parent to hear this show. So if you're just listening now, then go to the podcast and listen, because there's definitely important content that we have discussed today. Before we end the show, I'm going to ask you both the same question I ask every guest of mine for the past decade. And that is, what is the one thing you wish and hope that people knew or did different for a better future for our society?
Sure.
Nick, start with you.
I think for me it's that we're not that powerful, but we are that powerful. We're not that powerful to break someone else's heart. We're not that powerful to ruin someone else's day, but we're powerful enough to enhance their day, to make things better. And it really comes down to the understanding that because it comes from the point of being negative towards ourselves, that we are a bad influence on the world, and to be positive, that we are far more effective being positive than we are negative to ourselves and to others. And then also with regards to the technology, creation, yes, with a phone, creation rather than consumption. That's
amazing.
How I helped myself create video, photos, start an app, build something, create, don't consume.
Amazing. Garth.
I think my biggest ending point, my biggest wish, or my biggest is to realize that you are not alone.
Mm.
There's always help out there. There's always somebody who's been through the same thing as you've been through, who's willing to help. Speak out, communicate in little ways and big ways. If you're a parent, a loved one, a suffering addict, whatever your problem is, you're not alone. Speak out, plant the seed in somebody and ask a question. Get help. You don't get charged. There's no commitment. Ask the question. Phone any rehab, any helper, any therapist, anyone of Healing Wings branch and say, I need help. Ask me about this.
And, amazing.
And people will be happy to talk you through anything.
Literally, there's people out there that want to help. And that's incredible. And that's really amazing. And I guess very strongly in line with the work you do, just being there for the people and supporting and helping.
If I can add one quick thing, and I think we need to acknowledge the work that you do, because there is nothing tougher in this world, I believe, than dealing with addicts on a daily basis and running a program and building a program. It can be soul-destroying when you start going to funerals, when you start seeing people who haven't been able to succeed after 15, 20, 30 years. And I don't think those that are working in the programs and that are supporting in centers and doing the work actually get enough acknowledgement. So as an alcoholic, I'm saying thank you to
you
and your team. Amazing. For what you do.
And thank you for turning it around and putting it back in, which is even as important.
Amazing. And specifically the idea, sometimes I think of your therapist and thinking of, you know, how hard it is to invest in someone out of the goodness of your heart, and the person feels like you're controlling them and feels that they hate you back. And that's amazing. You're putting in love and care, and they're fighting against it. But it changes, and you do have happy stories also. So that's
what keeps us going.
That's what keeps it. It's amazing and incredible. Thank you so much for being with us today. Thank you so much to Gareth Lucas from Healing Wings for all the work you do. It's really, really impressive and special to know that you're really out there for society. Thank you so much to Nick Ingle for your insights and the work and everything you're doing and giving back into the community and really being that support. I think there's a lot more we need to discuss, the three of us, about the community and what we can do and how we can do. Maybe we should chat again before Purim or something, as we do as a very important discussion. But I'll say what we always say in Erev Purim. If someone says no, says let it go. Let it go. Mm-hmm. You don't know what anybody's battling. Mm-hmm. You don't know what anybody challenges you. You offered a whiskey to your friend. He said no, thank you. Let it go. And that's it. Don't challenge them. That's fine. Thank you, Vusi, for managing this program so nicely, perfectly. Thank you, Senna, for putting these interviews in place. And thank you to our listeners that are with us week after week here again and again. Stay safe. We'll be back next week, Monday, at 11 o'clock. In the meantime, enjoy. There are so many more great programs to hear on Chai FM until we continue Monday, 11 o'clock. I was Rabbi G. Enjoy.